March 1992. It had been nearly 3 months since the Soviet flag lowered from the Kremlin, and the tricolor flag of Russia was raised in its place, a sign to the world that the USSR was officially no more. In Riga, Latvia, the streets were bustling with citizens finally able to speak freely and enjoy life in a newly independent country. But the shadow of the Cold War was still ever present, and secrets still needed to be revealed. As the city was in the midst of discovering a new normal, no one seemed to notice as 70-year-old Vasily Matrokin made his way towards the American embassy. He dragged with him an old wheeled case filled with food and a change of clothes, giving the appearance of a grandfather on his way to meet his long-lost family. Except that buried at the bottom of his case lay stacks of KGB secrets. For over 12 years, Matrokin had carefully smuggled documents out of the KGB archives, and it was time to share them. As he entered the imposing front doors, he saw a lobby flooded with people applying for asylum. But Matrokin hadn't come all the way from Moscow to be deterred by a long wait. So he sat, ate a sausage from his case, and patiently waited his turn. After some time, his name was finally called. He was led into a quiet back room and met with an unnamed young man. Matrokin explained how he worked for the KGB and had access to material that almost no one else did. Then he started pulling files out of his bag. Dozens and dozens of papers that he carefully copied from the KGB basement. Examples of corruption and human rights abuses in the decades of Soviet rule. And even better than that, he knew the code names and real identities of hundreds of illegals or undercover agents who had been living in the West and spying for the Soviet Union for decades. The young man glanced at the papers, then back up at Matrokin. The disguise worked too well. All the American saw was an old man with copied nonsense. The young man told him he would need to come back later, and if he did, to bring official documents, not notes. Of course, that wasn't possible, since all he had were notes. Matrokin's heart sank. Had all those years of risking his life been for nothing? This is Espionage, the Parcast original exploring the missions of the world's most incredible spies and what brought their covert operations into the public eye. And throughout this show, we'll explore real-world spy tactics required to impersonate, exploit, and infiltrate the most confidential places in the world. I'm Carter Roy. You can find all episodes of Espionage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Espionage for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Espionage in the search bar. This is our final episode on Vasily Matrokin, the KGB archivist who has been called the greatest whistleblower in the history of the Soviet Union. For over 12 years, he painstakingly copied and smuggled documents out of KGB headquarters, building the most complete record of KGB operations anywhere. At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love, so let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review wherever you are listening. It really does help. Last week, we explored how and why Matrokin switched from spying for the Soviet Union to spying on them, and how he used his spy training to smuggle tens of thousands of documents right out from under the KGB's nose. This week, we'll follow Matrokin's escape from the Soviet Union, his fight to bring this information to light, and some of the dark secrets KGB was desperate to keep hidden. After retiring from the KGB in 1984 in his early 60s, Vasily Matrokin spent the next 7 years organizing his stolen notes. He had plenty of time to copy and file them as he waited for the perfect opportunity to share his treasure trove. When the Berlin Wall fell in 1989, Matrokin knew that the time was nearing. though it would still be 4 years until the opportunity presented itself. Well, that opportunity finally came in March 1992, 3 months after the Soviet Union officially dissolved. With Russia and the newly independent states frantically establishing new governments, Mitrokhin saw the chaos as a chance to make his moves. He boarded a train to Riga, Latvia, hoping to pass his information to the Americans at the local embassy. But the Americans, it turns out, didn't believe that Mitrokhin had anything substantial to offer them. Although we don't know the specific details of the meeting, we do know the rejection left Mitrokhin frustrated. He had risked his life for over a decade gathering documents. It couldn't have been for naught. Mitrokhin couldn't bring himself to board the train to Moscow, a failure. Crossing the border again meant risking a search of his belongings, and looking like an old grandpa wouldn't save him if the KGB discovered his extensive notes on classified material. As he walked the streets of Riga, he saw the British embassy. Sure, the British might also write him off as a doddering old fool like the Americans had, but he'd already come all this way, and so, with his cart of sweaters, sausages, and secrets, he tried the Brits. Mitrokhin approached the heavy door of the British embassy and entered. He was stunned to find a lobby that was calmer, emptier than the American one. Apparently, most of the people looking to leave the former Soviet Union were aiming for the land of Coca-Cola and McDonald's, not the land of tea and crumpets. After a brief wait in the lobby, he was taken to a private room and welcomed by a young, attractive woman who remains anonymous. Upon seeing her, Mitrokhin's stomach sank. He wanted to bring his secrets to an agent or a diplomat, someone who would truly appreciate the implications of such a massive collection of documents, not a secretary. But just as he was about to leave, the young woman offered him a cup of English tea. Mitrokhin perked up. He had read about English tea, but never had the real thing. He knew it would be rude to leave after such a generous offer, so he settled in and said yes. As they drank, the young woman chatted with Mitrokhin in fluent Russian. He thought this was very impressive for a secretary and immediately felt that there was something trustworthy about this woman. So Vasily Mitrokhin opened his case, dug to the bottom, and pulled out a stack of papers. Mitrokhin walked her through his past as a KGB spy, how he knew firsthand the atrocities of the Soviet gulags, and how he was transferred to the archives at the height of his career. He revealed his growing distrust of Soviet leaders and how he started smuggling documents in his shoes. He didn't know what he was going to do with the information he smuggled. He just felt that someday it would be important. Then he presented her with some of the documents. As he started to explain their significance, she interrupted him and began asking questions. Smart questions. It finally dawned on him that this young woman wasn't a secretary at all. She was some sort of diplomat. More importantly, she believed him. But getting someone official to believe him was just the first of many hurdles Mitrokhin needed to cross. The next being that the British embassy in Riga had no intelligence station. The capitalist West was just starting to set up diplomatic operations in post-Soviet countries, and they still lacked a lot of resources. Mitrokhin learned he needed to wait for MI6 agents to come from London to officially examine the documents. Afterward, they would decide how to proceed. Mitrokhin agreed to come back in a month to meet with the agents. Crossing the border two more times would still be a risk, but one Mitrokhin was now prepared to take. He shook the young woman's hand, thanked her for the tea, and boarded the train back to Moscow. After another month of waiting and reorganizing his files, Vasily Mitrokhin got on another train to Riga on April 9, 1992. Since the first journey had passed without incident, this time he came with 2,000 pages of documents. When he returned to the British embassy, Mitrokhin spent an entire day with MI6 investigators. He carefully went over each document he snuck in from Moscow, answering every question they had. And he did it all while sipping on English tea. and to prove that he was who he said he was, Matrokhin flashed his KGB credentials. He had his picture taken by MI6 agents and was officially on the record as betraying the KGB. There was no turning back now. Around 20 years had passed since Matrokhin had begun building his secret archive. Now he was officially sharing it with a foreign intelligence agency. MI6 was intrigued and impressed. So much so, they asked him to come back to Riga in 2 months to discuss a visit to Britain. Matrokhin was delighted. On June 11, 1992, Matrokhin returned to Latvia for the third time in 3 months, and he brought with him even more documents. However, he knew he couldn't go on like this forever. He had tens of thousands of documents. It would take him more than the rest of his life to bring them back and forth by train. Matrokhin visited Britain for the first time on September 7, 1992. Details to how he got there are still classified. He spent 3 weeks meeting with the most senior British intelligence officials, and it was all done in complete secrecy. With the help of MI6, Matrokhin was shuttled back and forth between a London warehouse and a cottage in the remote English countryside. They made sure he didn't stay in one place for too long for fear of raising suspicion. Over the course of those 3 weeks, Matrokhin finally started to think about his own future. It wasn't good enough to just get his archive out of Russia. He wanted to be there to help interpret it, catalog it, and write about it. He wanted to personally make sure that the world learned the truth about what had been happening for decades inside the Soviet Union. In order to do that, Vasily Matrokhin would have to leave Russia for good. On October 13, 1992, he returned to Russia to make plans to fully defect. The next time he left Russia, it was going to be his last. He needed to make arrangements for his wife Nina and their adult son to accompany him. He had worked hard to keep his life as a spy separate from his family's life. Throughout all his years of spying, neither of them suspected a thing. But as desperate as he was to get his documents to safety, he couldn't leave his family behind. Over the course of the history of the Soviet Union, thousands of people had defected, escaping the country for political or religious freedom elsewhere. But according to Vladislav Krasnov in his book Soviet Defectors, the KGB Wanted List, the number of defectors who are alleged to have taken secrets with them is 32. Vasily Matrokhin was one of the few defectors who could provide insight into the inner workings of the Soviet bloc. If any authorities learned what he was doing, he'd be a wanted man. And if his family stayed in Russia, they might end up dead. After long, difficult conversations, Matrokhin's wife and children finally agreed to leave Russia, the only home they had ever known. Though in many ways, Matrokhin had already made their choice for them. November 7th, 1992, was the 75th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution that led to the creation of the Soviet Union. Fittingly, it was also the day that Vasily Matrokhin saw his homeland for the final time. He boarded the now familiar train from Moscow to Riga, but this time he was joined by his wife, his son, and 10 volumes of notes that he had transcribed. When he left Russia, he didn't tell anyone he was leaving. He couldn't risk a friend or co-worker letting the information slip to the KGB. His disappearance was so subtle that his Russian pension kept being paid into his old Moscow bank account. Matrokhin took only a fraction of his total archive when he left Russia in November 1992. 6 aluminum trunks of notes were still buried underneath his family's country house outside of Moscow. MI6 promised Matrokhin that they would send their people to retrieve them. It was still difficult for Matrokhin to put his trust in a group of intelligence officers he had only recently met, but he knew he had no other choice. A few days after leaving Moscow, the family arrived in London. MI6 quickly set them up with a safe house, a pension, and new identities. Just like the illegals that Matrokhin had exposed, he was now living in the West under an assumed identity, But instead of spying for the KGB, he was waiting for his containers of secrets to be smuggled out of Russia. Matrokhin's fate was now in the hands of the British, the very people he had spent his professional career working against. Coming up, Vasily Matrokhin teams up with a historian to bring his secrets to the public. And now back to the story. After months of back and forth between Moscow and Riga, Vasily Matrokhin finally left his home for the last time. On November 7, 1992, Matrokhin, his wife Nina, and their son, who remains anonymous, were exfiltrated from Russia to England by a highly trained team of MI6 agents. Once in the United Kingdom, Matrokhin waited for word that the rest of his secret KGB archive had made it out safely as well. Oh, given how big the archive actually was, most of it had been left buried at his family's country home when Matrokhin defected. MI6 had promised to retrieve it. Details of this operation are still classified, but we do know that not long after Matrokhin and his family arrived in London, six large metal containers, muddy and damp from their years under the floorboards, made their way to MI6 headquarters. Roughly 20 years after he began smuggling information, the full Matrokhin archive was finally out of Russia. Matrokhin and his family settled into a quiet life in London. They lived under assumed names, financially supported by the British government. Though he began to assimilate to British life, Matrokhin still preferred to cook his favorite Russian cabbage soup. His new life in England was quiet and safe, and soon he grew restless. He didn't want to leave his papers for someone else to interpret. He wanted to make sure as much of the information was published as possible. The world deserved to know. MI6 agreed, with a caveat. He couldn't do it alone. Matrokhin was 70 when he left Russia, and there was far too much information for one elderly man to synthesize and translate. The clock was ticking. It took a few years, but MI6 finally found someone they thought could help Matrokhin bring the archive to the public. Well, Matrokhin was skeptical at first. He had introduced other intelligence officers to his archive bit by bit, in many meetings over the course of months. Matrokhin had learned to be methodical when it came to revealing information, to do it at a gradual pace. Now, British intelligence was basically asking him to devolve the secrets in rapid succession to a non-spy, an outsider. To Matrokhin, it was an absurd ask. But, deep down, he knew he had no other choice. He agreed to the meeting. So, in October 1995, 73-year-old Vasily Matrokhin waited patiently in a conference room at MI6 headquarters, a shiny postmodern building on the bank of the Thames in central London. He sipped a cup of English tea, a custom he'd now grown used to. In strode 54-year-old Christopher Andrew, a dark-haired, brown-eyed professor of history at Cambridge University, and the official historian of the British Security Services. Matrokhin balked. He believed historians focused too much on context and comparison. His archive, he thought, could speak for itself. But as it turned out, Andrew was no stranger to KGB secrets. For almost 10 years, he had worked with Oleg Gordievsky, a former KGB agent who had switched sides and spied for the British. The two of them had published several books on the KGB, including KGB, The Inside Story, and Instructions from the Center, Top Secret Files on KGB Foreign Operations 1975-85. One of their biggest revelations was exposing a British spy named John Cairncross, who smuggled nuclear secrets from Britain to the Soviet Union. Andrew looked over some of Matrokhin's material. He was astonished at how complete of a record he had smuggled out. Andrew later wrote, "Its scope and secrecy took my breath away." But Andrew, like MI6, knew that if Matrokhin was going to get this information into the hands of the public, it needed to be properly translated and contextualized. And he firmly believed he was the man for the job. Matrokhin, of course, remained skeptical. He was used to working alone. Well, it's unknown how Andrew eventually won Matrokhin over. Like most of Matrokhin's life, much is either still classified or shrouded in mystery. However, Matrokhin ultimately agreed to work with the history professor. He knew that the KGB's behavior had to be exposed, and now in his 70s, he wanted to make sure he was still alive to see it. Matrokhin had a singular focus and worked tirelessly to explain his notes to Andrew. Matrokhin didn't care about making money, nor the fame this book could bring him. In fact, Matrokhin wanted to remain anonymous. All he cared about was making sure that the job was done right. Andrew also believed in the mission, but as he worked alongside Vasily Matrokhin, he learned just how extraordinary he was. Andrew became convinced that the archive needed to contain the story of the man who assembled it. Matrokhin deserved recognition for all his hard work, and the rest of the world deserved to know who had made such an incredible sacrifice. Matrokhin remained skeptical of Andrew, but he liked him enough to join him on a visit to Cambridge University in 1996. It was a casual visit. They had lunch, took a tour of campus, and admired the architecture. As they walked, Andrew noticed something peculiar. Well, he expected Matrokhin to look out of place on the Cambridge campus. 73-year-old Russian, out of his element. He thought that everyone would surely notice a lost old man gawking at his new surroundings. But as they spent the day passing by Andrew's colleagues, none of them remarked on Matrokhin. He blended in so completely that it was almost as if he had made no impression on anyone at all. Andrew had admired the archive that Matrokhin assembled, but for the first time, he admired his talent and skills for spycraft. Late that afternoon, Andrew led Matrokhin to one of his favorite places on campus, Trinity Hall. Now, to most observers, this would have been just another one of Cambridge's residential colleges, but to Matrokhin, it was so much more. Among the KGB, Trinity was famous as the home of a group known as the Magnificent Five, a group of English students who collectively became spies for the KGB from the 1930s to the 1950s, eventually defecting to the Soviet Union. Well, frequent listeners may remember them from our episodes on Donald MacLean. To Russian spies, these men were heroes. The full extent of their clandestine work was documented in detail and sent to the KGB archives. Matrokhin was fully aware of the Magnificent Five. In fact, some of the documents he smuggled out of Moscow chronicled their work. Matrokhin knew exactly what Andrew was doing by taking him to Trinity. Since Andrew taught at the same institution where the Five were recruited, it meant their work together was personal for him as well. They were in this together. For the next 3.5 years, Matrokhin and Andrew kept working on organizing all of Matrokhin's material, and in that time, the existence of the archive and the subsequent book were held in the strictest confidence. After decades of working in isolation, Matrokhin had come to enjoy having a writing partner and several high-level officials he could confide in. For Matrokhin, the weight was finally being lifted off his shoulders. Though he could tell Andrew grew frustrated when he wasn't able to discuss his work with his colleagues. But as they approached the publication date, a sudden leak of sensitive information threatened to expose both Matrokhin and Andrew, putting the future of the archive in jeopardy. Coming up, Vasily Matrokhin's life's work is potentially threatened when a journalist catches wind of the archive. And now back to the story. Since October 1995, former KGB archivist Vasily Matrokhin and Cambridge history professor Christopher Andrew had been working together to organize Matrokhin's trove of KGB secrets into a cohesive account. The book, chronicling crimes the Soviet Union committed over the course of 75 years, was certainly going to have global repercussions. But in the late 1990s, only a select few members of MI6 knew about Matrokhin and Andrew's work. keeping the information secure meant keeping Matrokhin and his family safe. Even the British Parliament was unaware their country housed a turncoat. However, British intelligence did share select bits of information with foreign governments. They wanted to help other countries find and track former Soviet spies hiding in their midst. If they waited until the information went public, they risked spies escaping. However, some of those countries were less than diligent when it came to secrecy. In December 1998, Andrew received a call from a reporter in Germany with disturbing information. The reporter knew Vasily Matrokhin's German code name and had gotten his hands on some of the Matrokhin archive translated into German. The reporter also knew a book on the KGB was forthcoming, and he wanted to be the first to get the scoop. Andrew refused. That didn't stop the story from running in a German newspaper. This terrified Andrew and Matrokhin. Would the KGB catch on? Would they locate Matrokhin? And if so, would they kill him to protect their secrets? Having been a KGB spy, Matrokhin knew exactly what the organization was capable of. The Soviet Union may have fallen, but the images of starvation and forced labor in the gulags were still burned in his head. The story ran in a few other European newspapers, but the British press never picked it up, and if the Russians heard about it, they didn't seem to pay it much attention. International consensus seemed to be that this mysterious archive was nothing more than a few random documents, nothing worth getting excited about. In their London office, Matrokhin and Andrew breathed a sigh of relief. Their secrets and their lives were still safe. By the summer of 1999, Matrokhin and Andrew were right on schedule with their work. The archive had been organized, analyzed, and prepared for publication. Their calendars were marked for September. MI6 had begun briefing members of the British government about the archive, including future Prime Minister Tony Blair. But there was still one last thing Matrokhin needed to decide. Would he really publish his life's work anonymously? After decades of working in secrecy and years of living under an assumed identity in Britain, Vasily Matrokhin decided it was time to come out of the shadows. It isn't entirely clear as to why he had the sudden change of heart, perhaps because of his age. Perhaps after living a few years in England, he no longer feared the KGB. Only Matrokhin himself knew why. But at the 11th hour, he agreed to use his real name in the book and allow Andrew to share his story. Vasily Matrokhin's life was about to become public. On September 11, 1999, The Sword and the Shield, the Matrokhin Archive and the Secret History of the KGB was published. Simultaneously, pieces of it began to be serialized in The Times in England and other papers around the world. Now, the world was captivated. Western countries were shocked to find out how the Soviet Union had been secretly attacking and manipulating them throughout the entirety of the Cold War. Descriptions of assassinations, sabotage, and terrorism all took the world by storm. However, it was the revelations of Soviet disinformation that captured the most attention. In 1947, just 2 years after the end of World War II, the Soviet Union created the Committee of Information. Its purpose was to spread lies through newspapers, radio, and other media to influence public opinion. This strategy was known as disinformatia, or in English, disinformation. But what began as a tactic to improve Stalin's popularity and soften his image ended up a large part of the KGB's Cold War strategy. The book details the story of the systematic attempts to sabotage J. Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI. Well, starting in the late 1950s, the KGB forged letters to align Hoover with unpopular causes, like the John Birch Society. Soviet agents acquired John Birch Society's stationery and copies of its leaders' signatures, Then they forged a letter from Hoover to one of the leaders, pledging it funds and offering good wishes. Given that the John Birch Society was a far-right organization, any kind of connection to them would certainly have damaged Hoover's reputation. Well, luckily, no editors fell for the forgeries, and the letters were never printed. But the minor defeat didn't stop the KGB from attacking Hoover's credibility, nor did they limit themselves to only U.S. government officials. In fact, the Soviets even worked on influencing one of Hoover's greatest political enemies. The KGB was in contact with secret Communist Party members in Martin Luther King Jr.'s inner circle. The hope was that the communists could influence King's rhetoric in a more anti-American direction. However, it didn't work. King continued steadfastly in his belief that traditional American institutions were the best avenue to justice and equality. So the KGB decided to take a different approach. Instead of manipulating King, they would discredit him and replace him with a more radical leftist leader. They wrote articles calling King an Uncle Tom and accusing him of being in the pocket of the Johnson administration in the hopes that his followers would lose faith in him as a leader. When King was assassinated, the KGB pounced on the chance to spread lies that the U.S. government was involved. Given the racial tension already in the air during the 1960s, the KGB didn't really need to do much to stoke the flames. While the United States was definitely shocked at the secrets Matrokhin revealed, and the United Kingdom, the archive was an even bigger scandal. The public now became aware of spies in their own backyard. One of the most important parts of Matrokhin's archive was the true identities of spies, both British and Russian, who had spent decades hiding in plain sight in the UK. And because Matrokhin's archive was such a closely guarded secret, many within the British intelligence office had no knowledge that identities were about to be exposed. And when the first reports began to be published in the papers, there was a mad scramble to track down and locate the remaining illegals in England. One of the first to be found was an 87-year-old great-grandmother named Melita Norwood, who was quickly given the name Great Granny Spy, and the spy who came in from the co-op. She was Britain's longest-serving Soviet agent. Norwood had worked at a British nuclear facility from 1937 to the mid-1970s. Over those decades, she repeatedly leaked information on the system's uranium fuel cladding and post-irradiation corrosion resistance, which helped the Soviet Union develop better weapons and nuclear reactors. On the morning of September 11, 1999, the day the first stories hit the papers, Norwood watched as a morning news anchor read accounts of her decades of espionage. It wasn't long before reporters flocked to her front door, eager to find out what a great-granny spy looked like. But the gathering crowd wasn't angry. They didn't yell or shout for her arrest. They were mostly amused. Neighbors excitedly told reporters about how the kind elderly lady was a proud communist. She drank tea from a Che Guevara mug and sold her own fruit preserves to raise money for Cuba. But no one ever guessed that she was much more than just a communist sympathizer. After a few hours, Norwood finally left her house to face the crowd of curious onlookers. As reported by Christopher Andrews in the introduction to the paperback edition of The Sword and the Shield, Norwood was unapologetic, stating, "I did what I did not to make money, but to help prevent the defeat of a new system which had, at great cost, given ordinary people food and fares which they could afford, given them education and a health service. In the same circumstances, I know that I would do the same thing again." Well, even though Melita Norwood made for an amusing human interest story, many in the UK were furious that these spies had operated for so long and had never been punished. Even though the Soviet Union was long gone, these citizens still wanted justice. The British government, though, decided not to press charges against Norwood and other agents who were exposed in the Matrokhin archive. Their purported reason was that the accused were too old and no longer constituted a threat, especially since it had been nearly a decade since the Soviet Union had collapsed. Public opinion disagreed. Many accused the government of trying to cover up the failings of MI6 and MI5. How could they let these agents operate undetected for so long? Even if not all the exposed spies were brought to justice, Matrokhin still considered the publication of his archive a huge success. His goal was to expose a corrupt system, not punish individual agents, and in that, he succeeded. The official Russian response to the archive was to downplay its significance. However, internally, it presented a major problem, especially for the KGB. They could no longer use their existing illegals or other undercover agents because they could not be sure if their identities had been compromised. In a single swoop, Matrokhin had thrown Russian intelligence into chaos. Another success for this 77-year-old Matrokhin. While the world made sense of the 700-page book of secrets, the media was hungry to talk to the man behind it. They wanted interviews with the man who had pulled off the greatest theft of Soviet documents ever, but Matrokhin wasn't interested in the attention. He remained under the radar even as he traveled all over the UK on his senior citizen's rail card. Ever the spy, he knew how to blend in. But not long after The Sword and the Shield was released, Matrokhin and Andrew were back to work on a second volume, this one covering KGB interference in Latin America, the Middle East, Asia, and Africa. And in 2002, they released a book called The KGB Lexicon, an invaluable dictionary of KGB terminology. But as he and Andrew were in the midst of writing the follow-up to The Sword and Shield, Matrokhin suddenly became ill with pneumonia. And on January 23, 2004, he passed away at the age of 82. A year later, in 2005, the world was going our way, the KGB and the battle for the Third World was posthumously released. Even after his death, Matrokhin's archive continued to expose the violence and duplicity of the Soviet regime. When the KGB demoted him to the archives, it proved to be among the most costly mistakes in the history of the Cold War. With a wealth of information at his disposal, Matrokhin was able to fully grasp the breadth of Soviet atrocities. The smoke and mirrors that worked on millions of Russians failed on him. And for 12 long and arduous years, he was able to sneak this information out right under their noses. An inconsequential archivist proved to be one of the greatest spies in Cold War history. Vasily Matrokhin showed the world that it only takes one individual to expose the corruption of an entire regime. Thank you for listening to Espionage. We'll be back Friday with a new episode. You can find more episodes of Espionage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Espionage, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker. To stream Espionage on Spotify, just open the app, tap Browse, and type Espionage in the search bar. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll be back next week with another deep dive into the world of clandestine operation. Espionage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Andy Waits, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Joel Stein, and Travis Clark. This episode of Espionage was written by Margaret LeBron. I'm Carter Roy.